The following presentation was recorded at the Christian Light Education Fall Workshops. More information at clp.org.
What are some reasons to teach beyond the textbook?
Can't really capture enthusiasm too much in a textbook. I guess people don't think
of. All right, yeah. Enthusiasm comes from outside the textbook. We can't print textbooks with enthusiasm in them. The enthusiasm has to come externally rather than from the textbook itself. We say that the Bible is a living book. Why? Because we're excited about it. Because the Bible doesn't have a pulse, but a pulse develops there. As we read it and study it and apply it, the Bible has a lot of meaning to it. Okay? Sparks interest. Enthusiasm. It builds awareness, especially when we do activities of discovering things, like science, where we experiment, we demonstrate, we discover what happens when we do this, when we do that. We'll talk about some of that. It gives us an imagination that maybe I can find out what happens in this, or what has happened, and to explore those things, to find out just what did cause the War of 1812. What were the causes of these things that happened back in history, and to search for reasons why we are where we are today. How did the United States, for example, develop a two-party system of Republicans and Democrats? How did that come about? And you study history to find out, how did that develop, and how has it come to where it is today? The personal rewards for inquisitiveness, where I found out, I studied hard and I learned what caused this, and there's some satisfaction in having discovered the reasons for these things, or what happens when we try this or that. And it builds in them a desire to take their education beyond their formal schooling. That when they're done with 8th grade or 12th grade or whatever, they're not done educating themselves. They have learned to study beyond the textbook, and there are so many sources of information out there that they can go and it's so easy today with our electronic means that it's right there at our fingertips. We can pull it up real quickly. I'm amazed with Ryan on our trip here. Whatever subject, it seems like he knows the right things to push on his little black thing, and he can get the information for it just like that, you know. It's so easy, but how to find it in books is also very, very important. Where can we find it in writing? One of the things that we are told, I did a little bit of writing for CLE, and one of the things that we are told is just because you find it on the internet does not verify it. There are people who put false information on the internet. If you find it in print, it's more likely to be correct. And how long that will be true, I don't know. But we want to this research and study skills of finding things to be verified and to be true. Building good study skills. Sometimes my students would ask me, why do we need to do this research paper? Why do we have to do this or that? You know, in the classroom, maybe you never heard those things, but I certainly have in my 12 years of teaching. Well, it's because you need to learn how to study. And one of the reasons that you need to study is because you could be preaching to me someday, or to my children or grandchildren. You might be teaching Sunday school, and I want you to know how to study your lesson and teach it and preach it correctly. And it is a blessing to see some of our students becoming those kinds of people that are very good at teaching and preaching. All right. How do we do this, teaching outside the textbook? Well, we don't have much on these walls, but in a classroom. I toured some of the classrooms here just to see what's on the walls. What did I see? Maybe you haven't been in the room, but what do you imagine are on the walls?
Posters.
Posters, yeah. Very good teaching tools. What else?
Mottos. Mm-hmm. Helpful math things, I think, or some of
them. Okay, yeah, the math facts, the grammar facts, charts, maps, diagrams, just you know, the graphs, it's just lots of things that are that we can put on the wall, rules, spelling rules or whatever, and they are outside the textbook, but they are there. And when the student looks at those examples of manuscript and cursive letters up there, it's a reference point, and it helps them in their learning process to see things. Some students learn basically by seeing. You can give a student a text to read, and they read it once, and they know what's in there, and they can answer lots and lots of questions. The next person, student can read it three times and still don't know what it said. But you tell them, and then they remember. What kind of learner is that? That's an auditory learner. They learn by hearing. They might not be able to comprehend when they read it, but when they hear it, it sticks. And that's why to talk about a lesson helps, rather than just giving it as a reading assignment. To hear something, to do your drills aloud, you know, go over your math drills, and to hear it and to do it helps with them. Using mnemonics, where you have your little rhymes that you use. Sometimes some people would despise those things and say they're just a crutch. Well, if you break a leg, you know, a crutch is a useful tool. And so what? Use a crutch if you need to. And to remember, have you used mnemonics in music at all? Like the keys?
Okay. Like doe and deer, is that what you're talking about, that type of thing?
The what?
Like doe, deer, female deer, that type of thing, is that what you're talking about?
Okay, I don't know that one.
Okay, yeah. Are you just thinking like flat boys eat apple dumplings greedily?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Good deeds are bearing fruit. Yeah, those are mnemonics that help us to remember. We can look at that. Or King Philip came over for Girl Scouts.
Not sure what that one covers.
Know what that one is? Kingdom Phylum class. I have to think it through. Kingdom Phylum class. Order. Genus Species. I missed one in there. But that's what it is, the taxonomy. I would have to think it through to get it, but yeah. Family is the one I miss. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. Yeah, that's a mnemonic. King Philip came over for Girl Scouts. It helps. Yeah, then there's those students who learn by doing. They learn. And sometimes you'll have, especially a first grade student who's trying to learn the alphabet and trying to learn to write those A's and B's or to recognize them in the reading and to sound them out, and they have trouble with that because the only practice they've had with it is with a lead pencil on paper. And then to have them take Play-Doh and roll out those strings of Play-Doh and form a capital A and form a lowercase a and form a B and a C and do the whole alphabet in Play-Doh. And they love to play with Play-Doh. And then, well, here's something constructive you can do. Make the alphabet. And that's your alphabet. And there's something about that that certain students will learn their alphabets better by doing, whereas other will not. I was in a class one day visiting. Last winter, I visited 53 schools for CLE as a school rep in southeastern Pennsylvania. And I was in a first and second grade room, and the students were on the floor, and there was newspapers and magazines and paper snibbles all over the floor. What are these students doing? They were looking through those magazines and newspapers for a collection of how many different A's they could find and pasting them on paper.
I mean the font.
The font, yeah. Different colors, different sizes, different shapes, different fonts of A's. And it helped them to recognize A's in any font rather than just what was in their books. And she said then, sometimes we do it that way, sometimes we see how long it takes to to collect the whole alphabet. Sometimes they then find the letters, and then they find something that starts with that letter, and it helps. And she said it's especially important for those who are dyslexic. But she said it helps the others, and the dyslexics don't know that we're doing it for them because it's a whole class activity, and it just it's something they can do, and it helps them to learn that way. Well, there's making models, drawing pictures. You might have a student who it just doesn't sit. But he's always swiveling his chairs, just moving around, can't sit still and all that. What can you do to help him? Well, I read one time that the Jewish rabbis dealt with this same thing in their synagogue schools, where students just became bored with sitting in their seats in the synagogue school back in Jesus' time. And so there would be a time of the day when they would take their students out for a walk, and they'd do their memory work, their scripture recitation, as they walked down along the road. And what it was giving them some activity, giving them exercise as their brains were being engaged in doing their memory work. Maybe some value in that sometimes. Instead of sitting in their desks and plugging away at Bible memory, okay, let's do a walk and say your Bible memories and walk the perimeter of the school ground. And that a boy who can't sit still, or the girl who's playing with their hair the whole time, you know, they can do something else while they walk and do their Bible memory. Let's stay together and say our Bible memory as we go the whole way around. They're just some ideas of some things to do. Look for collections of insects, leaves. Rocks, different kinds of roots, just lots of different things. Dig up a piece of ground, 2 feet by 2 feet, about 4 inches deep, and see how many different varieties of living things you can find in there. Under a log, how many different varieties of animals are living under there, and make a collection of those kinds of things. Now, feather collections would be another one, rock collections. You don't want to do an insect collection in January here, probably, right? Florida, you might be successful, but probably not here, not in Pennsylvania. Insects and leaves in the wintertime are just pretty drab, pretty scarce. So we have to remember those things. Sometimes you take a curriculum and you see that by the time I get to insects, it's going to be January or February. Well, why don't we study that in September already, or October? And then when we get to that in the book, we'll skip over and go to the next. Books should not be a chain and ball that you have to take them in order the way they're written. You should be able to have that flexibility and put something in the season where it works so that you can do those out of the textbook activities. Maybe you have more thoughts on some of these things. I don't want to do a monologue here. All right, another reason for going beyond the textbook is because textbooks are written with differing points of view. And while one book might have one point of view, what's another contrasting point of view? You may not want to get those other books for the students, but at least to see it and to see the difference. How does a secular book address this subject? How does a Baptist book address this subject? How does that differ from our Anabaptist curriculum that we're using? And to see those differing points of views, different agendas, different photos and diagrams and different experiments. I love to go to these used book sales and used bookstores and pick up old textbooks and see the experiments that are in there for science. Some of them are more simple and less costly than some of the other experiments that I'm more familiar with the substances and feel more comfortable doing it. Different experiments and demonstrations, additional explanations of how to do it. It might be the same demonstration, but different instructions on how to do it. And here's something kind of vague in the other list of things to do. But in this one, it's, oh, so that's part of this, or that's what they're referring to. They may be more recent, or there might be more of a better coverage of a certain time period in another textbook. Or, for instance, in an encyclopedia, a more detailed information. Might be explanations for slow learners or some difficult subjects, concepts. Another thing about reaching outside the textbook is to draw different studies together. You might be studying U.S. history this year. How does that relate to things that were going on in the world at that same time period? We think about the time of the American Revolution. What was going on in the world at that time? Well, there was the French Revolution and French and Indian War and all those things that were going on with that. What was happening with our Anabaptist forefathers? They were coming to America in the early 1700s to escape war. And here, what did they do? They stepped right into America, right before the French and Indian War, the Revolutionary War, and the War of 1812. they jumped from the frying pan to the fire. here they are in the New World. But to tie some of those things together. Another interesting thing I learned was that coming to the time of World War I, that the Mennonites in Russia had an agreement with the Russian government that they could have alternative service instead of serving in the military. But they were involved in forestry and in the hospitals and so on during World War I. World War I was going on here, Mennonites and Brethren and the peace churches, the Quakers and Seventh-day Adventists, were going to prison because there was no alternative service here. So when World War II came along, our Mennonite leaders negotiated with the American government to have the same thing that Russia gave their citizens, an alternative to warfare. And so we had CPS in World War II. It started in Russia. And it was the Americans followed the Russians in that. Russia was ahead. And granted their citizens more freedom than what we had here in the United States. A blessing to us to see that there are different influences in, what are some activities? Building models. What models have you built? Any models in your classroom?
The one year I taught, we built bridges.
Okay. Out of?
Popsicle sticks.
Popsicle sticks? Okay. Mm-hmm. Pretty big, huh?
It was kind of a competition. You span 18 inches and break them and see who's most weight. So.
Okay. Oh, you tested them then to see how much weight they could? Okay. So. Good. Yeah. What are their models? Anything?
We built volcanoes one time.
Okay.
It's been a while.
Active volcanoes?
Well, we tried to be. Some of them didn't work so well as I remember. We got a few good ones.
Yeah, good.
What is it, like baking soda and Pepsi or mm-hmm. something?
Yeah, make a foam come out. Remember they shot up a little bit too. Yeah. My wife remembers when she was in about fourth grade, their teacher had them put their desks all around the perimeter of the room, and in the middle they had a big piece of cloth, and they drew roads on there, and they put everybody's house on the road. Now they were living close together, it was public school, and so they had everybody's house that was in that class on those roads. And she said they had fun with that. They spent several weeks of that in their free time, after their lessons were done. And so they hurried to get their lessons done so that they could put their house or their friend's house on the road of their neighborhood. One of the things that we enjoyed is electroplating a spoon. We're studying that electroplating, and why don't we try it? Okay, so I went to an appliance store. I got a range cord, for electric stove. They picked it out of the trash and gave it to me, and I took it, and we put salt water in a fishbowl, and we got an old spoon from Martha's cabinet that she said we may use, and put that on the other end for the other what you call it, in electroplating. The terms escapes my mind. But then the range cord, the copper from the range cord went over onto the spoon, and we coated that in just a matter of a few minutes. That with a flashlight battery, and didn't take long. And we had a copper-plated spoon. What did it cost us? Practically nothing to do that. And they said, they'd like to do it again. Well, why don't we hook it up backwards, take the copper off? So we did, took the copper off the spoon and put it back on again. It was fun, and they could see the electroplating process going on from diode to diode. What happens if we mix yellow and blue paint together? We'll get
green.
Green, yeah. They're studying pigments. Let's see how that works. Dump a little of this together and a little of that together and see what happens. And neighbors in Latin America, we have this what tea experiment. I think maybe that would be in here. No, I know where I have it. What it is, it's you dig a hole in the ground, and then you put charcoal in there and light it. The light charcoal and the hot coals, and you bring potatoes and wrap them in aluminum foil and put a little butter in with them. Do it about 9 o'clock in the morning. Cover it with dirt. And then at lunchtime, go out, take the dirt off. Everybody gets a potato. It doesn't have to be the one they brought, but everybody brings a potato, and you have a hot potato for lunch. It's a latia experience. It's the way they do it in Latin America, with those that have a baked potato. Of course, they would probably do it with firewood instead of charcoal. You can test the pH of the school water and see if it's hard or soft. See if the water softener is working. Take a sample of pond water and compare. Look at that pond water under the microscope. The microscope's a wonderful thing for discovering things. It's fascinating what you can see with a microscope. But you can show them why they should not be drinking pond water. What all is living in there, you know, all those paramecium and whatever is in there. One thing that we really enjoyed, we're studying about blood cells and health. So I went to the store and bought two little goldfish, which don't cost you much money. We brought those goldfish to school and wrapped them up in a paper towel. And we took a medicine dropper and kept adding water to the paper towel, had the fish wrapped up in the paper towel, had the tail sticking out, and that put that tail underneath the microscope. And looked at that, and you could see the capillary with blood cells going through single file through that capillary, and you saw the pulse of the fish that was struggling to keep on breathing inside. Pretty rapid. It's just fascinating to see the blood cells. We're actually looking at blood cells in our book talking. They're live blood cells and they're moving. The two fish, neither one of them survived. But it was interesting, and it sparked their interest in studying about blood cells because they, and capillaries. They saw that. Another thing that we did was, you ever burn a Pringle? You have Pringles out here, right? You ever burn a Pringle? You talk about fats in the diet? Take a Pringle and hold it with a tweezer and a lighted match underneath and see what happens. You get a flame like that high, and it'll burn for over a minute. And the reason you want to do it over a sink or outside is because there'll be burning drops of oil, possibly, coming off of that. I'm not guaranteeing, but we've had it, the burning drops of oil all off that Pringle. Okay, who wants to eat the rest of the bag? Oh, they will. But they realize what you're talking about when you say that these chips are loaded with fat. Because it's just fascinating how long they will burn like a cat. We used to time them to see how long they would burn. Some of them burned it for over a minute. A flame, nice big flame. Yeah. You ever see anybody walk, demonstrate how to walk on eggs? Get about three cartons, you know, a dozen carton of eggs, barefoot an hour is probably good, but if you step lightly on this dozen eggs, and lightly on that dozen eggs, and lightly on the next dozen eggs, you can step off, and not one will crack. It's the strength of an egg shell. And it's fascinating that God has made those eggs so strong. Now, if you bounce on them, of course, something's going to happen. But if you step lightly on them, you can walk across eggs without cracking a one. The strength of that thin eggshell to support that body weight. Another thing that we did was we're studying about the capacity of the lungs. Yeah, how much air is in your lungs? How much air can you put in your lungs? So you take a glass gallon jug, fill it completely with water, screw the lid on. You ever do this? Turn it upside down in the washbowl that has some water as well, and then screw the lid off, and take a plastic tube. Just inhale to the maximum that you possibly can, and blow in that tube, and blow air into that gallon jug, and see how much water you can force out of that gallon jug. Now, there'll be some students that will empty it or almost empty it, but very, very few will empty it. And sometimes that big football player will not nearly empty it as much as that little petite girl. It's lung capacity. If she's a runner, she can way outdo that big guy that's too fat to run. I want to say that respectfully, but, you know, it's surprising what can be the difference between one person and another. Some of it is determination as well, because some are just more determined than others to empty it. But it helps them to see, you know, wow, all that air was in my lungs? Yeah. And it came out, and there was more air in that than that, because we could never completely empty our lungs, or we'd have to go to the hospital because our lungs would collapse. We'd have to have medical help to get them refilled again, if possible. So there's still more air than that. It's amazing, the lungs that God has given us. Precautions to take. I would say that what is an experiment for your students should be a demonstration from your vantage point. That you should know the outcome. It's dangerous to experiment with something with a class of students that you don't know what's going to happen. That's pretty dangerous. So you should know that, but you don't have to tell them what the outcome is going to be. They can see it for themselves as you demonstrate it. Now, sometimes there is value in telling them what the outcome will be so that they can watch for it, especially if it's something that happens quickly, something that happens momentarily in the process. Now, look for this to happen. This is going to happen. See if you can catch it when it happens and see that. Any other thoughts on that? Or anything so far? Do you like to do field trips? Yeah. Field trips should be fun. They should be enjoyable. But they should connect with something we're studying. Something in our society. My wife says one of the best field trips she ever took was when her teacher took them to the sewer plant. And they saw a water treatment process being done, you know, where they take the sewage and they clean it up and make it that it could be drinking water. They release it into the stream, which goes into the river and down. And then people pull it out and do other stuff with it, you know, but it's clean when it comes out. And she said, that was really interesting. That was a worthwhile trip to go to the sewage plant. But they really enjoyed it. All right. Something with their with society. One of the most enjoyable ones that I did with my students when I took them to court. We sat in on a court trial. Have you done that? Yeah. We have to be careful. In our county, it was possible to learn what the trial was going to be about and to decide which trial to sit in and which ones to reject. That was very, very nice that they left us know what it was, basically what it was going to be about. it was an accident or if it was a drug trial or if it was a robbery or whatever. But we knew a little bit what it was going to be. It was going to be something of an immoral nature. Of course, we didn't want to take our students in on that. But to see the court in action was very interesting and informative. Where they if they are ever called into court, they won't go in there not knowing at all what a courtroom looks like or what happens there. And the judge explained the process to us privately during the recess time. And it was a very informative day. And it did a few things for them. One was that it gave them a mental remembrance of what a courtroom is like and the judicial system, where they understood that better. The other is that it gave them, when we talk about the judgment seat of Christ, we talk about the judgment bar, they knew what it's like then to be before that judgment seat and to give account of yourself. They had a reference point for that then, which I think was very helpful. Any more on that or anything? Maybe you have questions. All right. I have a list here of different sources of information: the dictionary, the thesaurus, the encyclopedia, the almanac, atlases, concordances, so on. Things that can help in looking up things and gathering information where you would go for each source of material. I would just add there, as far as atlases, one that I would really recommend is Operation World. Is anybody familiar with Operation World? Operation World is like an almanac in some respects, in that it gives a country by country a description, the political system, the culture of the people, the languages there, the population, the products that are produced, and then it has the spiritual description also. What are some things to pray for about this country? And they are updated fairly regularly. I'm not sure if it's quite every year. Do you?
I don't know. I had a copy, but it's been years ago. I haven't really kept up with them.
Yeah. I suppose they're still being published. I haven't seen any for a few years now, but they are very good. I would encourage you, if you have interest in that, to do that. Books of Quotation. Operation World. Yeah. I really liked the one I had. Bilingual dictionaries. Especially if you are teaching about Latin America, you're teaching about Europe, you're teaching about where there are different languages than English, and there are places that have names, and what are the, are there any meanings to these names, or are they just names? For instance, we talk about Rio de Janeiro. And we find out that the correct pronunciation of that is Rio de Janeiro. And what does Rio de Janeiro mean? River of January. Or you might come across a name of a man, Casa de Vaca. What does Casa de Vaca mean? Is it just a name, or does it mean something?
House of Cow.
House of Cow. How would you like to have that name? And so you come up with Buenos Aires. What does Buenos Aires mean? It's just a name of a city, right?
Good air.
Good air, yeah. That's right. And so you find these things, if you don't know, you can look them up in a bilingual dictionary. You don't know the language. It might be German. Well, is there any meaning to this? And you find some interesting things. Oh, they're not all that significant, maybe. But it sparks a little interest in here. This is what this means. Conquistadores. What does conquistadores mean? It means the conquerors. The book might tell you, or it might not. You find that out by looking in a bilingual dictionary. All right. What precautions should we take? Well, we need to encourage our students to go to more than one source, especially in research papers. The first thing they're going to head for probably is the World Book. But there are more sources than that, and even better sources. That's a good source, but there are better sources than that available. And teach them to go to more than one source for their information. Teach them to rewrite it, put it in their own words, and put it in their own words with accuracy. so that what is there is correct. I read in a newspaper article one day that a truck hauling gasoline went through the harbor tunnel in Baltimore and sideswiped a bus, and there was a sudden explosion. That gas tanker exploded, and the mile per hour winds of his clock coming out both ends of the tunnels, I forget what the miles per hour, but it was phenomenal. And then I read that the truck was hauling 80,000 gallons of gasoline. That sound logical? 80,000 gallons of gasoline? Well, I happen to know that a tanker holds 8,000 gallons. They haul 80,000 pounds. So did the writer of that article mean 80,000 pounds, or did the writer mean 8,000 gallons? But a student could write that down. They got it from the newspaper, and it, 80,000 gallons of gasoline. Well, what's a cubic footage of a gallon? Multiply that out to 80,000. See how big that tanker would have to be. It's a wonder it got in the tunnel. And so verify the information. Have them document their sources. What sources did you use for this information so you can verify it without going back and verifying everything? Just the suspicious things, to go back and verify them. Make sure that they're not copying it down word for word as the encyclopedias or whatever they're using said, their source said. Because that is called
plagiarism.
I learned that in high school. I was in 10th grade, and I had a research paper. We were to write on a country, and it was like 4,000 words or something. It was a lot of words. I thought, I better pick a big country, because that's a lot of words. So I picked China. I went to the library, and I got the encyclopedia. I started going down through the whole different dynasties. After a while, I had my assigned number of words, and I handed my paper in. It came back in bold red letters across the top, plagiarism. I went to the teacher, I said, what does this word mean? He said, well, you like to go to the library and copy things down, go and copy it down. I never forgot the meaning of plagiarism. I had to bring it back to him, show him too. But make sure they're not involved in plagiarism. Of course, electronic sources, make sure it's okay with the church, with the family, and whatever you know that they are permitted. Make sure that it is being supervised. We took some students to the library, and there was no filters on the internet, and there was things came up that just were not. But we were there, we shut it down, just right like that. You have to make sure that you're not cutting them loose, that they wander off into something that they would not have blundered into otherwise. That you were instrumental in getting them started in a habit they can't shake for a lifetime or seemingly can. All right, let's look at some handouts here. Here was in Latin America. And while I'm passing these out, I'm going to ask you again if you have any other comments or questions. I do want to answer questions if you have some. All right, in this handout, turn to page 190 and 191. Here is an illustration of some beyond the textbook activities. You'll see on page 190, enrichment. That enrichment is an activity. It's a demonstration about what they call haggling. I would prefer the term bargaining. Haggling sort of, to me, seems a little derogatory, negative. But how you buy things. When you go to the market in a Latin American country, the vendor is going to start with a high price and you're going to offer him a lower price, maybe only half of what he's asking. And he expects you to do so. He doesn't expect you to pay what he's... If you would, he said, dumb gringo. You made me... North American, gringo is a term for North Americans. He meant pay me the full price. That's crazy. He doesn't expect you to pay that. He expects you to offer him lower, and then you negotiate until you get to the price. Do we do that in North America?
Yeah, students do on lunch every day.
Okay. Sure we do. When we buy you buy a tractor, you buy a pickup truck, you buy a car, you buy a house. No, we do the same thing. The person who is selling makes an offer, and we make one lower until we agree on a price. We do the same thing here. And But they do it on smaller things. They do it on vegetables. They do it on fruits. They do it on clothing. That's just the way you deal in Latin America. All right. It says here to set the students up with some products to buy and sell and see how they do in negotiating for prices. And they would enjoy it and do it with their lunches. Tomorrow we're going to do this with our lunches. Everybody brings a lunch and everybody's going to sell their lunch piece by piece. See what you get for it. Bring some money along. You probably should try to go home with about the same amount of money as you came with. See how you make out, if it's all in fun. All right. Page 192. There you're going to see the words, class discussion. That's beyond the textbook, isn't it? Certainly. Wherever you can have class discussion. I loved in history class or in science class, especially to ask the question, so what if it wouldn't have been this way? What if the French had won the French and Indian War? Oh, what if the South had won in the Civil War? How would that have changed things that we have today? Would we be speaking French if the French had won? Would there still be slavery in the South? Probably not. That war was really rather useless because slavery was dying out anyway. And it was to settle the state sovereignty issues more than slavery, personally. Another thing I said we would bring in about reading, you might have something in reading, and here's a certain author, what else did that author write? And look at some of the other writings, helps to give you more of a picture of the thinking of that author. What else did they write? And how can we understand that author? What other poems can we find on this subject? What other writings can we find that have to do with this subject that we're studying? The Pan-American Highway. Where does the Pan-American Highway go? There's interesting things about that. There's a map here. What we have in the back of the teacher's guide, which you have back there, is, I can have that for just a little bit. We have a CD in the back here that comes with the teacher's guide. It has recipes for Latin American food, which are delicious. I love Latin American food. And students, especially the boys, love to eat. How to make some Latin American food. There's different exercises. A lot of this material that I have here is printouts from that CD, and I wanted to make sure you have it. Wherever it says resource, that comes from the CD that's in the back of there. Here's another one, which is a worksheet. This is in place of light units. You'll find these also are very helpful exercises beyond the textbook. On that CD, it is one here where we have, I do need to let you know, but where you take two cities, one in the northern hemisphere and one in the southern hemisphere, and you compare the climates. If the one is at 30 degrees south and one is at 30 degrees north, what's the altitude, what's the climate like, the air currents, whatever, you know, and to compare cities at equal distance from the equator, north and south. Interesting. Here's a Guarani house. It's made from cardboard, where you peel off the outside layer of the cardboard so that the ribs and the corrugation appear like logs. And you can make that house with a grass on the roof, and you have a Guarani house. I'm sure you have other ways that you do outside the textbook. Sometimes people accuse me of thinking outside the box. And I don't care. I just like to bring things in from a different aspect and make them, try to help them to think outside the box a little bit. Okay. All right. Any comments, questions?
Have you ever heard of lizardpoint.com?
Of what?
Lizardpoint.com, it's a website.
Lizardpoint. Mm-hmm. No, I'll have to check it out.
It's a website where they have maps.
Okay.
And they have like that. You pick the country you want,
okay,
or the continent, and they have practice mode where they give you hints.
Uh-huh.
Or they give you three chances to do the right answer, or they give you a test mode and a strict test mode.
Uh-huh.
I used it for my sixth graders for the United for the States.
Okay.
So, and it grades you right away too.
Oh, okay.
So it does. They also have like rivers, mountains, capitals.
One of the things about the Pan American Highway is that you pick a country that the Pan American Highway goes through, and you have the student pick three places in a certain country, and three places they'd like to visit in that country that are close enough that you could go there easily from the Pan American Highway. Mm-hmm. One of those places, of course, would be my brother-in-law's place in El Salvador. I'd love to go there. That would be my country, I think, El Salvador. But pick any country and see what's there. There's a, on the CD, there's what's called a flat student. You can mail that to a missionary and have them make a diary of a day or a week or whatever. And it says they're to send a little money along for their time for filling it up. They mail it back. This is what they did in a day's time or a week's time. And just a little daily record of how they used to live in that country. Another thing you could do is have a missionary come in and talk to your students, or somebody who lived during CPS days, or who was drafted in the Vietnam War era and did some voluntary service or something, and to talk about the experiences from other cultures or other time periods. What was it like to, I like to tell children, but we didn't have sandwich bags when I went to school. We took our sandwiches and wax paper because there was nothing like a sandwich bag back then. We didn't have Velcro. There's a lot of things. We didn't have color pictures. I heard one man my age say that back when I was young, all the boys and men, they wore black pants and white shirts and have the pictures to prove it. See, it was just black and white pictures. That's the way they came out. Things were different. When we went up the mountain to go to church, we had to cross the mountain. When we went up the mountain, our windshield wipers were on vacuum. And so when the engine lugged down and it died down, we didn't have enough of vacuum to make the windshield wipers go. If it was raining hard, my dad had to let off the gas. So the windshield wiper would go so he could see, then he could lose enough of speed that he had to shift down. That's the way the car was. How was it not too many years ago? Things were different. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have computers. It was different. Yeah. And children can just be amazed at how old we really are. All right, thank you for your patience, especially even after bell time.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.